sometimes it's better for me to just sit back, bite my tongue, and then in 4 years I'll be able to say what I want.
There has been a gradual institutionalization of this code of conduct, the effect of which is to prevent people from ventilating their views. Bright students won't put up with it.
Buckley Fellows believe that all perspectives must be heard and examined in good faith.
They stand united against the formation of a liberal-only echo chamber at Yale.
We disagree, we debate, and then at the end of the day, we remain friends.
Welcome everyone to Pod and Man at Yale, the official podcast of the Buckley Institute. I'm your host, Ari Schaefer, Director of Communications at the Buckley Institute. Please subscribe to Pond and Man at Yale on the App Store, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please, if you like what you hear, leave a review or rate us. 5 stars only, obviously. If you don't like the podcast, leave a review on someone else's podcast. Today, we'll be discussing faculty political diversity at Yale and the resignation announcement of Yale President Peter Salovey with our esteemed panelist, Will Barbie, a sophomore returning after debuting on our inaugural podcast last week, and Will Wang, also a sophomore. So, in true Buckley fashion, let's get right to it. I'd like to welcome our panelists for today's episode of Pod and Man at Yale. We have Will Wang, a sophomore.
Thank you for having me, Ari.
And we've got back returning for the second episode, Will Barbie, also a sophomore.
Good to be back.
Well, today's topic for the episode is going to be faculty political diversity here at Yale. Over the summer, the Buckley Institute released a report on faculty political diversity. Across 4 departments in the law school, we saw 83% of faculty were registered as Democrats, but only 3.5% registered as Republicans. So we looked at, again, the law school, political science, history, philosophy, and economics. Does that surprise you?
I don't think it surprises me. I think academia generally has a preference for Democrats, and full disclosure, I am one myself. But I think that is a little disheartening to see, especially in the political science and global affairs department, in the social science department, where we expect to see a lot of debate. I think it's a little constraining to have a faculty that particularly leans one way and not a lot of the other view being presented by Yale.
Yeah, I think that it's also very interesting how the Buckley program, or Buckley Institute, I should say, chose to conduct this survey specifically on the departments that where political diversity matters most, right? So questions of politics are most likely going to come up in terms of political science, philosophy, history, things like that, law. And so to see that that has a political diversity that's lacking is much more concerning than to say that I think, you know, the STEM fields are lacking in political diversity.
Have either of you had experiences with professors in class that would kind of demonstrate the bias that we found in our report? Barbie?
Well, you know, I found my professors to be liberal, most of them, in the sense that they are more free-thinking, more open-minded. They conduct class in a way that's a little bit more lenient, a little less sort of strict and stringent. They're more sort of, how would you say, sort of, you know, they conduct class in a way that's more free and student-based rather than necessarily professor-based, sort of like a top-down approach. But you know, I feel like ultimately most of the professors that I've had in the humanities departments that I've taken classes in have been relatively, done a relatively good job at mitigating their biases.
Will Wong?
Sure. I think they definitely do have biases, but they do disclose those biases. I had a professor, David Blight, with Will Barbie, and he of course is very progressive, but he labels himself as progressive. And similarly, I have a conservative professor, Steve Calabresi, at the law school, and he does disclose that he is a conservative. So I think to the point that they do disclose that, I don't think they're actively trying to shift us one way or the other, but they are mainly presenting their bias and then affording us the opportunity to make our own judgments.
So does this bias among the faculty, the political bias, does it impact how you approach new classes, new professors that you haven't had before? Do you think twice about how you write essays or write test answers? Will Wong, you want to start us off?
I actually try to push that a little bit. So when I have a conservative professor, I try to write something that perhaps even goes a little bit more to the right. And if I have a more liberal professor, I try to write a paper that's perhaps even more to the left. I don't think that's
Is that a trolling kind of thing?
I think it is fun. It's definitely fun to write a paper or do a skit. I did a skit with Will Barbie making fun of cancel culture. That was the thing that's a little bit more to the right. I think it's definitely a fun enterprise to engage in. But I also think it's important just to broaden your own perspective. Like, I wrote a paper that for my constitutional law class that's a lot more progressive than my professor, who is a progressive. And just for the sake of doing that, I think it broadens your ability to accept different views when you try to embody those views yourself.
How about you, Will? Do you ever adjust for different professors?
Well, in terms of adjustment, I mean, I would say I definitely sort of, you know, adjust my approach when I first go into the class, and I recognize and I say, look, you know, maybe this professor will be slightly biased, right? But this is what we do whenever we read the sort of great works and the great authors, right? We analyze the historical context of the time that they were in, and then we talk about their lives and perhaps maybe how their biases and their personal lives influence their work and things like that. And so I think we should do the same with our professors, right? We should say, well, you know, we're reading these certain works, and why is he choosing these works, or she? Why are they choosing these works to be read in the class, and how do they sort of affect what we're going to be learning about, you know, this topic in history or English or political science or whatever it is? And then, you know, you work appropriately from there and take away what you can take away from it and reject the sort of fluff.
And to the professors' great credits, at least here at Yale, they seem to be very receptive to being challenged. They have that intellectual maturity and humility to hear different ideas, whereas I don't think a lot of the students, even my friends on the left, do have that same receptiveness. And I think that's a little bit dangerous, not necessarily to faculty, but perhaps to the classmates that we sit next to.
Yeah, definitely agree with that.
So you guys aren't worried that if a professor is liberal, you're conservative, or a professor is conservative and you're more liberal than they are, that might preclude you from opportunities such as TAing or maybe recommendation or some other program on campus?
I think there will be a more that would be a more important issue for the social sciences. I think both Will Barbie and I are humanities students, where we don't have to necessarily engage with modern political issues. But I do worry for some of my friends who are conservative, who are political science majors, who are a global affairs major, I worry about their chances.
So do you think the faculty bias, you know, it's wonderful, it, you know, doesn't really impact your day-to-day classes. Do you think it has an impact on the campus as a whole? Will Wong, you want to start us?
I don't necessarily think it's the professor that's the thing that's influencing campus culture the most. It's not professors we interact with in dining halls. It's not professors we see walking around on the street. It's not professors we're studying with. I think it's mostly the other students. And on this front, again, perhaps I'm more in line with a lot of the other Yale students. But sometimes when I do want to voice opinions that are perhaps dissenting opinions that won't be so palatable to the rest of the Yale population, I think I'm not most scared of professors taking offense at that, but more as students taking umbrage at that.
You go to a university in order to be educated by the professors and in order to be with students that you think will sort of, you know, propel you forward in the sense that you can bounce ideas off of them. And yet at the same time, I think that that is one of the things that least determines what a campus climate is. Instead, it's rather the sort of faces you don't see every day, the administrators, the bureaucracy that are working behind the scenes to sort of create a climate on campus that is much more, can be much more cold, I think, sometimes than we experience in the classroom, right? I think it's much more hidden.
How about within the classroom itself? Do you feel the political leaning of a faculty member has any impact on the tenor or, I guess, the acceptance for diverse ideas within the classroom itself?
Yeah, like a role model I look up to is Professor John Gaddis in the history department. And one class, he just took out his books and he made us read his books and he said, critique it. Tell me everything that is wrong with what I wrote. And I think just having that humility to be wrong is something that we should see a lot more of. But to the extent that exists, it's something that I really appreciate. The humility embodied in not just their works, but also in their receptance to other ideas. I had one class where the professor made a kid cry because the kid tried to raise a contrary point. And the professor didn't do it as a means of canceling the kid, but because he had so much pride in his work. Now, granted, he's one of my favorite professors, and he's very, very, very competent in what he does. But I think a little bit more humility would do us all very well.
And so one last question on this topic. Looking at this divide, you know, 83% Democrat, 3.5% Republican, I don't know if you guys have thought about academia in the future, but does that divide make you rethink the feasibility of it? Do you worry that maybe there's a little bit of a gatekeeping problem, considering the ratios are so off kilter?
I think I've come to a point where I tend to just not care anymore. I truly do believe that if I say anything that is egregious enough to have me sort of kicked out or gatekept, then that's probably my fault, because I trust that what I say is not ever meant to offend anybody. It's not ever coming from a place of malice or hatred or, you know, bigotry for another person. It's just simply my sort of mode of thinking. And if somebody is against my mode of thinking, then I think that that's, you know, I think that other people will look at that, and people who have common sense, and they'll say, you know, this is not right and this is not fair. So I don't really fear it anymore.
Are you, Will? Any thoughts on this?
Well, that's why I respect Will Barbie so much. It's certainly a lot easier for, say, someone like me who's a Democrat to get appointed in a position in academia than it is for a conservative. But I think that's what makes it worthwhile. And I don't want to speak for Will Barbie, but he is the man in the arena fighting for what he believes in right. Of course, there are times when we fight against each other, but like being so willing to go against a current is something I respect a lot in a lot of conservative academics, and someone like Steve Calabresi, who I'm taking class with right now at the law school. I wish people like him, who are conservative but are just wonderful and incredibly intellectual, would have a chance to teach at great universities, at Yale and at other places. We need more people like that to bring campus intellectual diversity.
President Salovey announced his resignation. He's been at Yale since 2013. You're both sophomores, but you heard about Yale before you got here, and now you've been here for a year. How do you think he's done as president?
I will say it can be sort of hard to form opinions about the president of a university, because that role is a very sort of – it's hard to pinpoint exactly what that role represents when there's so many factors working behind the scenes about how a university runs. But, you know, just to think about it in the sense of, like, somebody who represents my school on a sort of broader level, right, a broader scale, if the president is representing you. I don't know if President Salovey has always done the best job of representing all the views of the students at all the times. Obviously, it's impossible for one person to be able to represent the entire student body in a nutshell. But really just representing, I guess, what I would say, the core values of Yale, right, and the core values of freedom of speech, something like that laid out in the Woodward Report. I think that if, you know, President Salovey had taken more seriously the claims of the Buckley program and the petition of the Buckley program to implement the Woodward Report into freshman orientation, I think that, you know, I think we would have a more of a conversation here about, you know, just his legacy on the school.
Has the free speech environment at Yale gotten better based on what you know, based on what you heard about Yale and the free speech issues before you got here and your free speech experiences in the past year? Has it gotten better or worse? You want to start off, Barbie?
Sure. I mean, I think that each year that the Buckley program continues to do programs such as handing out the Woodward Report on old campus to freshmen and to older students as well, I think that that always is helping the process of making free speech better at Yale. I don't think that in my time here that administrationally it has gotten any better. You know, I've only been here a year, but it seems to be the sort of same climate and the same campus of not really being willing to address those issues surrounding free speech from a top-down approach at Yale. So I would definitely like to see more of that from the next president of Yale.
Sure, I think, and due credit to Buckley for promoting that value. I don't think free speech has gotten worse. I can't think of any major incidents of free speech violation in the last year or two, and correct me if I'm wrong. But I do think something that's dangerous and perhaps we haven't talked too much about is the fact that people are isolating themselves more in their particular isolation bubbles or echo chambers. And if you go to a class with a progressive professor, you'll see mostly progressive students. And if you go to a class with conservative professor, you'll mostly see conservative students. And I've done both. And I think the lack of political and intellectual diversity in the classroom is something that we so need to address, although Buckley is doing that with our seminars.
So what do you both think is the role of the president of the university in an issue like free speech? And then I'll ask you, you know, more broadly, but what should President Salovey be doing about free speech, or what should the next president be doing do about free speech? Barbara, you want to start us off again?
Yeah, I think just the president needs to be that individual who stands up for the rights of everybody on campus to speak and who is willing to go beyond that and to say, you know, violations of that code are not acceptable.
So what do you guys think, what do you guys want in your next president outside of free speech issues? They're going to be doing the search over the next year. They either have settled on a search committee or are putting it together. What are the things you guys want out of your next president? Barbie, what do you want in your next president of Yale?
I'd say I want a president who is willing to go against the grain of the way that almost all colleges today in the United States are moving towards. Those kind of changes involving the sort of, you know, landscape of the growth of the bureaucracy on college campuses, the growth of tuition, the sort of emphasis on somewhat of coddling of students as opposed to sort of developing them through growth and intellectual purposes. I think that those are the sort of values that really make a university stand out from the rest of the sort of landscape that we have here in this country. And I think that really those are Yale's core values. I think they've somewhat strayed in the past few years.
All right, thank you. Will Barbie, Will Wang, I've switched your name back and forth like five times. So thank you both for coming. And I apologize to the audience. I'll try and get more name diversity in future podcasts.
There's only two of us Wills in the Buckley board, but we'll try to get more.
It's always a pleasure with this Will.
Likewise, the other Will.
All right, take care, guys. Thank you.
Thanks.
Now, with that, let's get right to our interview with Cornell University professor, Hoover Institution fellow, and classicist Dr. Barry Strauss, who gave the inaugural Donald Kagan Memorial Lecture for the Buckley Institute a few weeks ago. Check it out on our website or on our YouTube channel. Dr. Strauss is a classicist and a military and naval historian and consultant. He's the Bryson Edith M. Bomar Professor in Humanistic Studies at Cornell University, as well as Professor of History and Classics. He is also the Corliss Page Dean Visiting Fellow at the Hoover Institution. Dr. Strauss holds a PhD from her very own Yale University, having studied under Yale legend and Buckley Institute stalwart, Professor Donald Kagan. Thank you for joining us.
You're welcome. Pleasure to be here.
And thank you also for your wonderful lecture yesterday. By way of background for listeners, Dr. Strauss gave the inaugural Donald Kagan Memorial Lecture last night, titled How to Win a War, Ask the Thucydides. If you haven't already, do give it a listen on the Buckley Institute YouTube channel. Wonderful lecture. Really enjoyed it. Absolutely engaging. But I want to focus on today during this interview is the classics, why you study them and why you think everyone else should too. After the lecture, a student, a military veteran, by the way, asked for advice for future leaders. You said, read the classics. Why do you think that's so important?
Well, the classics are classics for a reason. They have they ask some of the fundamental questions of our civilization. And they ask them really in such an early period of civilization that there's something charming and about them, something unstudied about them. We can really see some of the issues that continue to face us today in their most basic and elemental form. For me, my entry drug to the classics was reading Thucydides. It was 1970. I was a freshman in college. The Vietnam War was going on. And reading Thucydides, I had to scratch my head and ask, is he writing about things 2,500 years ago, or is he writing about Vietnam and things happening today? That's how fundamental his questions were and are. Plato, Aristotle, the tragedians, so much more from ancient writings continue to resonate, and they force us to ask questions about who we are, where we've come from, and where we're going. I think that everyone can profit by by reading these works.
So let's cut to the heart of it. In your opinion, are the classics being studied enough today?
No, in my opinion, they're certainly not being studied enough today. They've come under attack, or at least they're looked down upon by people of all political stripes. From the left, the classics are thought of as exclusivist, white supremacist, colonialist, Exhibit A, and everything that's wrong with the Western past. But even people coming from the right or from no political opinion might say ancient history. Well, of course, that's a phrase in a normal American speech to mean something that's old and not important and water under the bridge. I think a lot of people have trouble understanding why we should study things from the past. How could they possibly be useful to us today?
So why do you think that is, that, you know, people, you know, you mentioned a couple of reasons that people give, but, you know, fundamentally, why do they turn away from the classics? I remember reading the founders, when they were trying to figure out what government to set up in the United States, they looked at the classics, and, you know, they were, you know, I guess a couple hundred years closer, but still a couple thousand years away from a lot of these writers. Why today have people suddenly decided, let's dispense with them, it's not worth it?
Well, I think that the West in the 19th century in particular broke with the past. There are various Western thinkers who said that we could begin again, that humanity could start again from year zero, as it were. The most famous of these is Marx, who said that human beings could, we could remake human nature and remake what human beings are. And I think history bears out the fact that that's not true, that there are real limits to human nature, and that the details may change, technology changes, but human nature remains fundamentally the same. And the same questions that we ask today were asked already by the class.
What are American students, the American American society losing by stepping away from, you know, this Western civilizational history and the classics?
I think by stepping away from the classics and from Western civilization, American society is in danger of losing its moorings. I think it already is detached from its moorings, and it can just get the problem can just get bigger and bigger. I mean,
this abandonment of the classics does have implications for our culture and our cultural moorings or our moral values.
Certainly. I mean, we need to know where we came from, and we need to know what some of the fundamental principles of society are. We also need to learn how to read, and to read skeptically, and to read carefully. I think that one of the real dangers now of living in the digital age, in the age of social media, and now we're entering this new world of AI, one of the real dangers is that people won't know how to read, and they won't know how to read skeptically. Yes, of course, they'll know how to read read text, but they won't know how to read between the lines. They won't know how to interrogate what they're reading. They'll think that you can write essays by pushing buttons, which, of course, now you could through AI. I think this is really dangerous because you want people to be able to think for themselves, to interrogate the text that they read, you know, to talk back to what they're reading, and to talk back to authority, to ask questions. And if they have this grounding in fundamental questions and fundamental things, they'll be infinitely better able to do that. If they don't have that grounding, they are prey. They are prey. They are potential victims for the predators that are out there that use communications to get people to do what they want rather than allowing people to make their own decisions about what they want.
So a student or a listener who wants, you know, to take, who wants to look at the Western civilizational classics and wants to be able to, you know, read deeply and think deeply about these questions, where would you direct them? First book, couple books that you think, or first couple writers you think are, you know, the core basic fundamentals?
Sure. Well, you know, it used to be assumed that anyone who went to college had read the Bible, but you can't assume that at all anymore. So everybody should read the Bible. That's what we should start with. But that, the Greeks and the Romans, I would say they should read Plato, they should read Aristotle, they should read Homer, they should read Cicero, Virgil. Those are some of the very basic ones that you could start out with. I think students could learn a lot by trying to get a grasp of what honor meant in earlier civilizations. The Red Badge of Courage would be a good place to start with that. After that, they could graduate to something like Plato, the Apology of Socrates, which is a very short text by Plato. And to try to read it carefully in a good translation and ask, what made Socrates tick? Why did Socrates take a position that defied the people of Athens? Why did he defy the jury? Why did he stand up there for his principles and risk his life, and in fact ends up losing his life? Why? What motivated him? What made that society work? From there, you could graduate to Homer's Iliad. And just reading the first book of the Iliad, in a way, you don't have to read more than that first book, and just try to say, what are these people all about? Your first impression might be that they're jerks, but then you'll realize that these are people for whom honor and glory and dignity is everything. And the question is, why?
So you mentioned honor a couple times in that answer.
Yeah.
Is that something you think is not part of kind of our cultural conversation?
It is definitely not part of our cultural conversation. Sorry, it's one of my hobby horses.
Sure.
But, let's hear it. You know, Thucydides, who is also immensely worth reading, but very difficult, and not something I'd recommend starting out with. Thucydides says that in international relations, people are motivated by three things: security, profit, and honor. And I think nowadays we'd all be able to understand why security and profit are things that motivate people. But honor is not something that resonates with our culture. I don't know if you agree with me, but I don't think it does. I think to make sense of it for people today, you have to ask them to think about prestige or credibility or reputation. And then they'll get a sense of what honor might mean.
So what does honor mean to you in this particular context?
Honor means that you do the right thing, not just because people are watching you, but you do the right thing because it's the right thing. You do the right thing because it's an internal code. You have your own code of ethics. You have your own code of values. And because you are a person of honor, you would live according to those values.
And so looking to the future, go as apocalyptic or as conservative as you want, what do you think happens to an America, a Western world that doesn't have this concept of honor?
Yeah, well, I worry about the future of America. I really do. It's lost the concept of honor to a certain amount. It's also lost the concept of civics and civic responsibility and responsibility to society. We have become a society of free agents in so many different ways that I really question whether Americans can deal with challenges, big challenges. If, for example, heaven forbid, the challenges of World War II were to face us again, could today's American society face those challenges? I don't know. I really don't know.
I mean, I could talk to you about this for a long time, but I do want to talk about Donald Kagan.
Right.
He has spent 40 years at Yale.
Right.
He's perhaps most famous for an iconic work he published on the Peloponnesian War. He was dean of Yale College for 3 years and was even the director of athletics here for a little bit. Mm-hmm. So what was it like to study under Donald Kagan, someone with such a broad repertoire of skills?
Don was unique. I've never really known anyone like him. I did have some really other excellent teachers, and I don't want to forget about them. So first of all, Don was a great scholar, and his erudition, his knowledge of Thucydides and antiquity and political thought was extraordinary. His ability to communicate, though, and the fact that he was so humble, and in so many ways a man of the people, to use an overused phrase, was really remarkable. It wasn't him up there and the rest of us down here, but he was always with us. As a lecturer, I can only envy his ability to be a lecturer. Some people seem to have this natural ability to lead, and he really did. There was a charm about him, a sparkle about him. His lectures were entertaining, they were riveting, they were funny. He was just so humorous. respectful. But the other thing about Don was his courage in the battles of academia. He was absolutely courageous. He was fearless. He would go out there, he'd put himself out there, and he would often be a voice crying in the wilderness. There were some other professors who joined him, but the majority of the faculty were progressive, or on the left, we would have said then, and they totally disagreed with Don. And yet Don was out there battling courageously for the things he believed
in. So here at the Buckley Institute, as you know, we launched the Donald Kagan Memorial Lecture and Fund in his honor to advance the values that he really stood for and fought for.
Yes.
If you had to choose just a couple lasting legacies that you remember from your time with Donald Kagan that the Buckley Institute should make a special emphasis on inculcating in today's Yale students, what do you think we should be looking to?
Well, certainly studying the classics and studying history. Don thought that was immensely important. I would say studying military history, studying the history of war, reading the classics, also continuing the tradition of great teaching, that would be part of it, and having voices on campus that speak for conservatives. Don was a conservative, and it's no secret that conservatives are an endangered species on the American campus nowadays. And I think the Buckley Institute would definitely be continuing Don's work if it stood up for conservative values and create, as it's doing so wonderfully, create a place on campus where conservatives can speak. And not only conservatives, you want everyone to be part of the debate. I think early in his career, Don was with his colleagues, and he was at Cornell, wrote a book or several volumes maybe about Western civilization, great issues in Western civilization. It was so Don, because it would take, it wasn't say this is right, this is wrong. It was debates. It was debates about things that really mattered in Western civilization. And that kind of teaching, debating, arguing, putting both sides of the question, not saying this hurts me, this makes me feel unsafe, but saying, let's get out there and argue and be friends and talk about things. I think that's part of Don's legacy as well.
Amazing. So just one last question we have. Yeah, we are the Buckley Institute, we mentioned. So you're going to ask this of everyone who comes on the podcast. How did Bill Buckley impact your life? Whether it was reading National Review, watching Firing Line, following his campaign for mayor in New York.
All of those things. So I grew up watching Firing Line on TV. It was really one of my favorite programs. And I thought Buckley was just so remarkable, His erudition, his style, his elegance, his conservatism were quite extraordinary. And the debates that he had, the people he had on Firing Line, I'm sure to watch them today would still be an education. I remember his mayoral campaign. I was young. I was growing up in New York City. And I remember his concession speech and how very stylish it was and how amused he was by the whole thing.
Thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Barry Strauss, classicist, professor at Cornell. Thank you also for giving the memorial lecture yesterday. It was wonderful to listen to. Again, to everyone, all our listeners, if you haven't listened to Dr. Strauss's lecture, go on our YouTube channel now and give it a listen. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
That wraps up another great episode of Pod and Man at Yale. Hit the subscribe button if you haven't already and leave a review. And always remember, for God, for country, and for Yale, in that order.